knew about our computer-based network and what it might mean for human life. What should be clear from the start is that this network will create entirely novel political and personal realities. The main message of the previous chapters has been that information isn't truth, and that information revolutions don't uncover the truth. They create new political structures, economic models, and cultural norms. Since the current information revolution is more momentous than any previous information revolution, it is likely to create unprecedented realities on an unprecedented scale. It is important to understand this, because we humans are still in control. We don't know for how long, but we still have the power to shape these new realities. To do so wisely, we need to comprehend what is happening. When we write computer code, we aren't just designing a product. We are redesigning politics, society, and culture. And so we had better have a good grasp of politics, society, and culture. We also need to take responsibility for what we are doing. Alarmingly, as in the case of Facebook's involvement in the anti-Rohingya campaign, the corporations that lead the computer revolution tend to shift responsibility to customers and voters, or to politicians and regulators. When accused of creating social and political mayhem, they hide behind arguments like, "We are just a platform. We are doing what our customers want and what the voters permit. We don't force anyone to use our services, and we don't violate any existing law. If customers didn't like what we do, they would leave. If voters didn't like what we do, they would pass laws against us." Since the customers keep asking for more, and since no law forbids what we do, everything must be okay. These arguments are either naive or disingenuous. Tech giants like Facebook, Amazon, Baidu, and Alibaba aren't just the obedient servants of customer whims and government regulations. They increasingly shape these whims and regulations. The tech giants have a direct line to the world's most powerful governments, and they invest huge sums in lobbying efforts to throttle regulations that might undermine their business model. For example, they have fought tenaciously to protect Section 230 of the US Telecommunications Act of 1996, which provides immunity from liability for online platforms regarding content published by their users. It is Section 230 that protects Facebook, for example, from being liable for the Rohingya massacre. In 2022, top tech companies spent close to $70 million on lobbying in the United States, and another €113 million on lobbying EU bodies, outstripping the lobbying expenses of oil and gas companies and pharmaceuticals. The tech giants also have a direct line to people's emotional system, and they are masters at swaying the whims of customers and voters. If the tech giants obey the wishes of voters and customers, but at the same time also mold these wishes, then who really controls whom? The problem goes even deeper. The principles that the customer is always right and that the voters know best presuppose that customers, voters, and politicians know what is happening around them. They presuppose that customers who choose to use TikTok and Instagram comprehend the full consequences of this choice, and that voters and politicians who are responsible for regulating Apple and Huawei fully understand the business models and activities of these corporations. They presuppose that people know the ins and outs of the new information network and give it their blessing. The truth is, we don't. That's not because we are stupid, but because the technology is extremely complicated and things are moving at breakneck speed. It takes effort to understand something like blockchain-based cryptocurrencies, and by the time you think you understand it, it has morphed again. Finance is a particularly crucial example, for two reasons. First, it is much easier for computers to create and change financial devices than physical objects, because modern financial devices are made entirely of information. Currencies, stocks, and bonds were once physical objects made of gold and paper, but they have already become digital entities existing mostly in digital databases. Second, these digital entities have enormous impact on the social and political world. What might happen to democracies, or to dictatorships for that matter, if humans are no longer able to understand how the financial system functions? As a test case, consider what the new technology is doing to taxation. Traditionally, people and corporations paid taxes only in countries where they were physically present. But things are much trickier when physical space is augmented or replaced by cyberspace, and when more and more transactions involve only the transfer of information rather than of physical goods or traditional currencies. For example, a citizen of Uruguay may daily interact online with numerous companies that might have no physical presence in Uruguay, but that provide her with various services. Google provides her with free search, and ByteDance, the parent company of the TikTok application, provides her with free social media. Other foreign companies routinely target her with advertisements. Nike wants to sell her shoes, Peugeot wants to sell her a car, and Coca-Cola wants to sell her soft drinks. In order to target her, these companies buy both personal information and ad space from Google and ByteDance. In addition, Google and ByteDance use the information they harvest from her and from millions of other users to develop powerful new AI systems that they can then sell to various governments and corporations throughout the world. Thanks to such transactions, Google and ByteDance are among the richest corporations in the world. So, should her transactions with them be taxed in Uruguay? Some think they should, not just because information from Uruguay helped make these corporations rich, but also because their activities undermine tax-paying Uruguayan businesses. Local newspapers, TV stations, and movie theatres lose customers and ad revenue to the tech giants. Prospective Uruguayan AI companies also suffer because they cannot compete with Google's and ByteDance's massive data troves. But the tech giants reply that none of the relevant transactions involved any physical presence in Uruguay or any monetary payments. Google and ByteDance provided Uruguayan citizens with free online services, and in return the citizens freely handed over their purchase histories, vacation photos, funny cat videos, and other information. If they nevertheless want to tax these transactions, the tax authorities need to reconsider some of their most fundamental concepts, such as nexus. In tax literature, nexus means an entity's connection to a given jurisdiction. Traditionally, whether a corporation had nexus in a specific country depended on whether it had physical presence there, in the form of offices, research centers, shops, and so forth. One proposal for addressing the tax dilemmas created by the computer network is to redefine nexus. In the words of the economist Marco Kurtenberger, the definition of nexus based on a physical presence should be adjusted to include the notion of a digital presence in a country. This implies that even if Google and ByteDance have no physical presence in Uruguay, the fact that people in Uruguay use their online services should nevertheless make them subject to taxation there. Just as Shell and BP pay taxes to countries from which they extract oil, the tech giants should pay taxes to countries from which they extract data. This still leaves open the question of what, exactly, the Uruguayan government should tax. For example, suppose Uruguayan citizens shared 1 million cat videos through TikTok. ByteDance didn't charge them or pay them anything for this. But ByteDance later used the videos to train an image recognition AI, which it sold to the South African government for $10 million. How would the Uruguayan authorities even know that the money was partly the fruit of Uruguayan cat videos, and how could they calculate their share? Should Uruguay impose a cat video tax? This may sound like a joke, but as we shall see in Chapter 11, cat images were crucial for making one of the most important breakthroughs in AI. It can get even more complicated. Suppose Uruguayan politicians promote a new scheme to tax digital transactions. In response, suppose one of the tech giants offers to provide a certain politician with valuable information on Uruguayan voters and tweak its social media and search algorithms to subtly favor that politician, which helps him win the next election. In exchange, maybe the incoming prime minister abandons the digital tax scheme. He also passes regulations that protect tech giants from lawsuits concerning users' privacy, thereby making it easier for them to harvest information in Uruguay. Was this bribery? Note that not a single dollar or peso exchanged hands. Such information-for-information deals are already ubiquitous. Each day, billions of us conduct numerous transactions with the tech giants, but one could never guess that from our bank accounts because hardly any money is moving. We get information from the tech giants, and we pay them with information. As more transactions follow this information-for-information model, the information economy grows at the expense of the money economy, until the very concept of money becomes questionable. Money is supposed to be a universal measure of value, rather than a token used only in some settings. But as more things are valued in terms of information, while being free in terms of money, at some point it becomes misleading to evaluate the wealth of individuals and corporations in terms of the number of dollars or pesos they possess. A person or corporation with little money in the bank, but a huge data bank of information, could be the wealthiest or most powerful entity in the country. In theory, it might be possible to quantify the value of their information in monetary terms, but they never actually convert the information into dollars or pesos. Why do they need dollars if they can get what they want with information? This has far-reaching implications for taxation. Taxes aim to redistribute wealth. They take a cut from the wealthiest individuals and corporations in order to provide for everyone. However, a tax system that knows how to tax only money will soon become outdated, as many transactions no longer involve money. In the data-based economy, where value is stored as data rather than as dollars, taxing only money distorts the economic and political picture. Some of the wealthiest entities in the country may pay zero taxes because their wealth consists of petabits of data rather than billions of dollars. States have thousands of years of experience in taxing money. They don't know how to tax information, at least not yet. If we are indeed shifting from an economy dominated by money transactions to an economy dominated by information transactions, how should states react? China's social credit system is one way a state may adapt to the new conditions. As we'll explain in Chapter 7, the social credit system is at heart a new kind of money, an information-based currency. Should all states copy the Chinese example and mint their own social credits? Are there alternative strategies? What does your favorite political party say about this question? Right and left. Taxation is just one among many problems created by the computer revolution. The computer network is disrupting almost all power structures. Democracies fear the rise of new digital dictatorships. Dictatorships fear the emergence of agents they don't know how to control. Everyone should be concerned about the elimination of privacy and the spread of data colonialism. We'll explain the meaning of each of these threats in the following chapters, but the point here is that the conversations about these dangers are only starting, and the technology is moving much faster than the policy. For example, what's the difference between the AI policies of Republicans and Democrats? What's a right-wing position on AI, and what's a left-wing position? Are conservatives against AI because of the threat it poses to traditional human-centered culture, or do they favor it because it will fuel economic growth while simultaneously reducing the need for immigrant workers? Do Do progressives oppose AI because of the risks of disinformation and increasing bias, or do they embrace it as a means of generating abundance that could finance a comprehensive welfare state? It is hard to tell, because until very recently, Republicans and Democrats, and most other political parties around the world, hadn't thought or talked much about these issues. Some people, like the engineers and executives of high-tech corporations, are way ahead of politicians and voters, and are better informed than most of us about the development of AI, cryptocurrencies, social credits, and the like. Unfortunately, most of them don't use their knowledge to help regulate the explosive potential of the new technologies. Instead, they use it to make billions of dollars, or to accumulate petabits of information. There are exceptions, like Audrey Tang. She was a leading hacker and software engineer who in 2014 joined the Sunflower Student Movement, which protested against government policies in Taiwan. The Taiwanese cabinet was so impressed by her skills that Tang was eventually invited to join the government as its Minister of Digital Affairs. In that position, she helped make the government's work more transparent to citizens. She was also credited with using digital tools to help Taiwan successfully contain the COVID-19 outbreak. Yet, Tang's political commitment and career path are not the norm. For every computer science graduate who wants to be the next Audrey Tang, there are probably many more who want to be the next Jobs, Zuckerberg, or Musk and build a multi-billion dollar corporation rather than become an elected public servant. This leads to a dangerous information asymmetry. The people who lead the information revolution know far more about the underlying technology than the people who are supposed to regulate it. Under such conditions, what's the meaning of chanting that the customer is always right and that the voters know best? The following chapters try to level the playing field a bit and encourage us to take responsibility for the new realities created by the computer revolution. These chapters talk a lot about technology, but the viewpoint is thoroughly human. The key question is, what would it mean for humans to live in the new computer-based network, perhaps as an increasingly powerless minority? How would the new network change our politics, our society, our economy, and our daily lives? How would it feel to be constantly monitored, guided, inspired, or sanctioned by billions of non-human entities? How would we have to change in order to adapt, survive, and hopefully even flourish in this startling new world? No determinism. The most important thing to remember is that technology in itself is seldom deterministic. Belief in technological determinism is dangerous because it excuses people of all responsibility. Yes, since human societies are information networks, inventing new information technologies is bound to change society. When people invent printing presses or machine learning algorithms, it will inevitably lead to a profound social and political revolution. However, humans still have a lot of control over the pace, shape, and direction of this revolution, which means we also have a lot of responsibility. At any given moment, our scientific knowledge and technical skills can lend themselves to developing any number of different technologies, but we have only finite resources at our disposal. We should make responsible choices about where to invest these resources. Should they be used to develop a new medicine for malaria, a new wind turbine, or a new immersive video game? There is nothing inevitable about our choice. It reflects political, economic, and cultural priorities. In the 1970s, most computer corporations like IBM focused on developing big and costly machines, which they sold to major corporations and government agencies. It was technically feasible to develop small, cheap personal computers and sell them to private individuals, but IBM had little interest in that. It didn't fit its business model. On the other side of the Iron Curtain, in the USSR, the Soviets were also interested in computers, but they were even less inclined than IBM to develop personal computers. In a totalitarian state, where even private ownership of typewriters was suspect, the idea of providing private individuals with control of a powerful information technology was taboo. Computers were therefore given mainly to Soviet factory managers, and even they had to send all their data back to Moscow to be analyzed. As a result, Moscow was flooded with paperwork. By the 1980s, this unwieldy system of computers was producing 800 billion documents per year, all destined for the capital. However, at a time when IBM and the Soviet government declined to develop the personal computer, hobbyists like the members of the California Homebrew Computer Club resolved to do it by themselves. It was a conscious ideological decision, influenced by the 1960s counterculture with its anarchist ideas of power to the people and libertarian distrust of governments and big corporations. Leading members of the Homebrew Computer Club, like Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, had big dreams but little money, and didn't have access to the resources of either corporate America or the government apparatus. Jobs and Wozniak sold their personal possessions, like Jobs' Volkswagen, to finance the creation of the first Apple computer. It was because of such personal decisions, rather than because of the inevitable decree of the goddess of technology, that by 1977, individuals could buy the Apple II personal computer for a price of $1,298, a considerable sum, but within reach of middle-class customers. We can easily imagine an alternative history. Suppose humanity in the 1970s had access to the same scientific knowledge and technical skills, but McCarthyism had killed the 1960s counterculture and established an American totalitarian regime that mirrored the Soviet system. Would we have personal computers today? Of course, personal computers might still have emerged in a different time and place. But in history, time and place are crucial, and no two moments are the same. It matters a great deal that America was colonized by the Spaniards in the 1490s rather than by the Ottomans in the 1520s, or that the atom bomb was developed by the Americans in 1945 rather than by the Germans in 1942. Similarly, there would have been significant political, economic, and cultural consequences if the personal computer emerged not in San Francisco in the 1970s, but rather in Osaka in the 1980s, or in Shanghai in the first decade of the 21st century. The same is true of the technologies being currently developed. Engineers working for authoritarian governments and ruthless corporations could develop new tools to empower the central authority by monitoring citizens and customers 24 hours a day. Hackers working for democracies may develop new tools to strengthen society's self-correcting mechanisms by exposing government corruption and corporate malpractices. Both technologies could be developed. Choice doesn't end there. Even after a particular tool is developed, it can be put to many uses. We can use a knife to murder a person, to save their life in surgery, or to cut vegetables for their dinner. The knife doesn't force our hand. It's a human choice. Similarly, when cheap radio sets were developed, it meant that almost every family in Germany could afford to have one at home. But how would it be used? Cheap radios could mean that when the totalitarian leader gave a speech, he could reach the living room of every German family. Or they could mean that every German family could choose to listen to a different radio program, reflecting and cultivating a diversity of political and artistic views. East Germany went one way, West Germany went the other. Though radio sets in East Germany could technically receive a wide range of transmissions, the East German government did its best to jam Western broadcasts and punished people who secretly tuned into them. The technology was the same, but politics made very different uses of it. The same is true of the new technologies of the 21st century. To exercise our agency, we first need to understand what the new technologies are and what they can do. That's an urgent responsibility of every citizen. Naturally, not every citizen needs a PhD in computer science, but to retain control of our future, we do need to understand the political potential of computers. The next few chapters, then, offer an overview of computer politics for 21st century citizens. We will first learn what the political threats and promises are of the new computer network, and will then explore the different ways that democracies, dictatorships, and the international system as a whole might adjust to the new computer politics. Politics involves a delicate balance between truth and order. As computers become important members of our information network, they are increasingly tasked with discovering truth and maintaining order. For example, the attempt to find the truth about climate change increasingly depends on calculations that only computers can make, and the attempt to reach social consensus about climate change increasingly depends on recommendation algorithms that curate our news feeds, and on creative algorithms that write news stories, fake news, and fiction. At present, we are in a political deadlock about climate change, partly because the computers are at a deadlock. Calculations run on one set of computers warn us of an imminent ecological catastrophe, but another set of computers prompts us to watch videos that cast doubt on those warnings. Which set of computers should we believe? Human politics is now also computer politics. To understand the new computer politics, we need a deeper understanding of what's new about computers. In this chapter, we noted that, unlike printing presses and other previous tools, computers can make decisions by themselves and can create ideas by themselves. That, however, is just the tip of the iceberg. What's really new about computers is the way they make decisions and create ideas. If computers made decisions and created ideas in a way similar to humans, then computers would be a kind of new humans. That's a scenario often explored in science fiction. The computer that becomes conscious, develops feelings, falls in love with a human, and turns out to be exactly like us. But the reality is very different and potentially more alarming. Chapter 7. Relentless. The network is always on. Humans are used to being monitored. For millions of years, we have been watched and tracked by other animals, as well as by other humans. Family members, friends, and neighbors have always wanted to know what we do and feel, and we have always cared deeply how they see us and what they know about us. Social hierarchies, political maneuvers, and romantic relationships involve a never-ending effort to decipher what other people feel and think, and occasionally to hide our own feelings and thoughts. When centralized bureaucratic networks appeared and developed, one of the bureaucrats' most important roles was to monitor entire populations. Officials in the Qin Empire wanted to know whether we were paying our taxes or plotting resistance. The Catholic Church wanted to know whether we paid our tithes and whether we masturbated. The Coca-Cola Company wanted to know how to persuade us to buy its products. Rulers, priests, and merchants wanted to know our secrets in order to control and manipulate us. Of course, surveillance has also been essential for providing beneficial services. Empires, churches, and corporations needed information in order to provide people with security, support, and essential goods. In modern states, sanitation officials want to know where we get our water from and where we defecate. Healthcare officials want to know what illnesses we suffer from and how much we eat. Welfare officials want to know whether we are unemployed or perhaps abused by our spouses. Without this information, they cannot help us. In order to get to know us, both benign and oppressive bureaucracies have needed to do two things. First, gather a lot of data about us. Second, analyze all that data and identify patterns. Accordingly, empires, churches, corporations, and healthcare systems, from ancient China to the modern United States, have gathered and analyzed data about the behavior of millions of people. However, in all times and places, surveillance has been incomplete. In democracies like the modern United States, legal limits have been placed on surveillance to protect privacy and individual rights. In totalitarian regimes like the ancient Qin Empire and the modern USSR, surveillance faced no such legal barriers but came up against technical boundaries. Not even the most brutal autocrats had the technology necessary to follow everybody all the time. Some level of privacy was therefore the default, even in Hitler's Germany, Stalin's USSR, or the copycat Stalinist regime set up in Romania after 1945. Gheorghe Iosifescu, one of the first computer scientists in Romania, recalled that when computers were first introduced in the 1970s, the country's regime was extremely uneasy about this unfamiliar information technology. One day in 1976, when Iosifescu walked into his office in the governmental Centrul de Calcul, Center for Calculus, he saw sitting there an unfamiliar man in a rumpled suit. Iosifescu greeted the stranger, but the man did not respond. Iosifescu introduced himself, but the man remained silent. So Iosifescu sat down at his desk, switched on a large computer, and began working. The stranger drew his chair closer, watching Iosifescu's every move. Throughout the day, Iosifescu repeatedly tried to strike up a conversation, asking the stranger what his name was, why he was there, and what he wanted to know. But the man kept his mouth shut and his eyes wide open. When Iosifescu went home in the evening, the man got up and left too, without saying goodbye. Iosifescu knew better than to ask any further questions. The man was obviously an agent of the dreaded Romanian secret police, the Securitate. The next morning, when Iosifescu came to work, the agent was already there. He again sat at Iosifescu's desk all day, silently taking notes in a little notepad. This continued for the next 13 years, until the collapse of the communist regime in 1989. After sitting at the same desk for all those years, Iosifescu never even learned the agent's name. Iosifescu assumed that other Securitate agents and informers were monitoring him outside the office too. His expertise with the powerful and potentially subversive technology made him a prime target. But in truth, the paranoid regime of Nicolae Ceaușescu regarded all 20 million Romanian citizens as targets. If it was possible, Ceaușescu would have placed every one of them under constant surveillance. He actually made some steps in that direction. Before he came to power in 1965, the Securitate had just one electronic surveillance center in Bucharest and 11 more in provincial cities. By 1978, Bucharest alone was monitored by 10 electronic surveillance centers, 248 centers scrutinized the provinces, and an additional 1,000 portable surveillance units were moved around to eavesdrop on remote villages and holiday resorts. When, in the late 1970s, Securitate agents discovered that some Romanians were writing anonymous letters to Radio Free Europe criticizing the regime, Ceaușescu orchestrated a nationwide effort to collect handwriting samples from all 20 million Romanian citizens. Schools and universities were forced to hand in essays from every student. Employers had to ask each employee to submit a handwritten CV and then forward it to the Securitate. "What about retirees and the unemployed?" asked one of Ceaușescu's aides. "Invent some kind of new form," commanded the dictator. "Something they will have to fill in." Some of the subversive letters, however, were typed, so Ceaușescu also had every state-owned typewriter in the country registered, with samples filed away in the Securitate archive. People who possessed a private typewriter had to inform the Securitate of it, hand in the typewriter's fingerprint, and ask for official authorization to use it. But Ceausescu's regime, just like the Stalinist regime it modeled itself on, could not really follow every citizen 24 hours a day. Given that even Securitate agents needed to sleep, it would probably have required at least 40 million of them to keep the 20 million Romanian citizens under constant surveillance. Ceausescu had only about 40,000 Securitate agents. And even if Ceausescu could somehow conjure 40 million agents, that would only have presented new problems, because the regime needed to monitor its own agents too. Like Stalin, Ceausescu distrusted his own agents and officials more than anyone else, especially after his spy chief, Jan Mihai Pacepa, defected to the United States in 1978. Politburo members, high-ranking officials, army generals, and Securitate chiefs were living under even closer surveillance than Iosifescu. As the ranks of the secret police swelled, more agents were needed to spy on all these agents. One solution was to have people spy on one another. In addition to its 40,000 professional agents, the Securitate relied on 400,000 civilian informers. People often informed on their neighbours, colleagues, friends, and even closest family members. But no matter how many informants the secret police employed, gathering all that data was not sufficient to create a total surveillance regime. Suppose the Securitate succeeded in recruiting enough agents and informers to watch everyone 24 hours a day. At the end of each day, every agent and informer would have had to compile a report on what they observed. Securitate headquarters would have been flooded by 20 million reports every day, or 7.3 billion reports a year. Unless analysed, it was just an ocean of paper. Yet where could the Securitate find enough analysts to scrutinise and compare 7.3 billion reports annually? These difficulties in gathering and analysing information meant that in the 20th century, not even the most totalitarian state could effectively monitor its entire population. Most of what Romanian and Soviet citizens did and said escaped the notice of the Securitate and the KGB. Even the details that made it into some archive often languished unread. The real power of the Securitate and the KGB was not an ability to constantly watch everyone, but rather their ability to inspire the fear that they might be watching, which made everyone extremely careful about what they said and did. Sleepless agents. In a world where surveillance is conducted by the organic eyes, ears, and brains of people like the Securitate agents in Iosifescu's lab, even a prime target like Iosifescu still had some privacy, first and foremost within his own mind. But the work of computer scientists like Iosifescu himself was changing this. Already in 1976, the crude computer sitting on Iosifescu's desk could crunch numbers much better than the Securitate agent in the nearby chair. By 2024, we are getting close to the point when a ubiquitous computer network can follow the population of entire countries 24 hours a day. This network doesn't need to hire and train millions of human agents to follow us around. It relies on digital agents instead. And the network doesn't even need to pay for these digital agents. Citizens pay for the agents on our own initiative, and we carry them with us wherever we go. The agent monitoring Iosifescu didn't accompany Iosifescu into the toilet and didn't sit beside the bed while Iosifescu was having sex. Today, our smartphone sometimes does exactly that. Moreover, many of the activities Iosifescu did without any help from his computer, like reading the news, chatting with friends, or buying food, are now done online, so it is even easier for the network to know what we are doing and saying. We ourselves are the informers that provide the network with our raw data. Even those without smartphones are almost always within the orbit of some camera, microphone, or tracking device, and they too constantly interact with the computer network in order to find work, buy a train ticket, get a medical prescription, or simply walk down the street. The computer network has become the nexus of most human activities. In the middle of almost every financial, social, or political transaction, we now find a computer. Consequently, like Adam and Eve in paradise, we cannot hide from the eye in the clouds. Just as the computer network doesn't need millions of human agents to follow us, it also doesn't need millions of human analysts to make sense of our data. The ocean of paper in Securitate headquarters never analyzed itself. But thanks to the magic of machine learning and AI, computers can themselves analyze most of the information they accumulate. An average human can read about 250 words per minute. A Securitate analyst working 12-hour shifts without taking any days off could read about 2.6 billion words during a 40-year career. In 2024, language algorithms like ChatGPT and Meta's Llama can process millions of words per minute and read 2.6 billion words in a couple of hours. The ability of such algorithms to process images, audio recordings, and video footage is equally superhuman. Even more important, the algorithms far surpass humans in their ability to spot patterns in that ocean of data. Identifying patterns requires both the ability to create ideas and the ability to make decisions. For example, how do human analysts identify someone as a suspected terrorist who merits closer attention? First, they create a set of general criteria, such as reading extremist literature, befriending known terrorists, and having technical knowledge necessary to produce dangerous weapons. Then, they need to decide whether a particular individual meets enough of these criteria to be labeled a suspected terrorist. Suppose someone watched 100 extremist videos on YouTube last month, is friends with a convicted terrorist, and is currently pursuing a doctorate in epidemiology in a laboratory containing samples of Ebola virus. Should that person be put on the suspected terrorists list? And what about someone who watched 50 extremist videos last month and is a biology undergraduate? In Romania in the 1970s, only humans could make such decisions. By the 2010s, humans were increasingly leaving it to algorithms to decide. Around 2014-15, the US National Security Agency deployed an AI system called Skynet that placed people on a suspected terrorists list based on the electronic patterns of their communications, writings, travel, and social media postings. According to one report, that AI system engages in mass surveillance of Pakistan's mobile phone network and then uses a machine learning algorithm on the cellular network metadata of 55 million people to try and rate each person's likelihood of being a terrorist. A former director of both the CIA and the NSA proclaimed that "we kill people based on metadata." Skynet's reliability has been severely criticized, but by the 2020s, such technology has become far more sophisticated and has been deployed by a lot more governments. Going over massive amounts of data, algorithms can discover completely new criteria for defining someone as suspect that have previously escaped the notice of human analysts. In the future, algorithms could even create an entire new model for how people are radicalized just by identifying patterns in the lives of known terrorists. Of course, computers remain fallible, as we shall explore in depth in Chapter 8. They may well classify innocent people as terrorists or may create a false model for radicalization. At an even more fundamental level, it is questionable whether the system's definition of things like terrorism are objective. There is a long history of regimes using the label terrorist to cover any and all opposition. In the Soviet Union, anyone who opposed the regime was a terrorist. Consequently, when an AI labels someone a terrorist, it might reflect ideological biases rather than objective facts. The power to make decisions and invent ideas is inseparable from the capacity to make mistakes. Even if no mistakes are committed, the algorithm's superhuman ability to recognize patterns in an ocean of data can supercharge the power of numerous malign actors, from repressive dictatorships that seek to identify dissidents to fraudsters who seek to identify vulnerable targets. Of course, pattern recognition also has enormous positive potential. Algorithms can help identify corrupt government officials, white-collar criminals, and tax-evading corporations. The algorithms can similarly help flesh-and-blood sanitation officials to spot threats to our drinking water, help doctors to discern illnesses and burgeoning epidemics, and help police officers and social workers to identify abused spouses and children. In the following pages, I dedicate relatively little attention to the positive potential of algorithmic bureaucracies, because the entrepreneurs leading the AI revolution already bombard the public with enough rosy predictions about them. My goal here is to balance these utopian visions by focusing on the more sinister potential of algorithmic pattern recognition. Hopefully, we can harness the positive potential of algorithms while regulating their destructive capacities. But to do so, we must first appreciate the fundamental difference between the new digital bureaucrats and their flesh-and-blood predecessors. Inorganic bureaucrats can be on 24 hours a day and can monitor us and interact with us anywhere, anytime. This means that bureaucracy and surveillance are no longer something we encounter only in specific times and places. The healthcare system, the police, and manipulative corporations are all becoming ubiquitous and permanent features of life. Instead of organizations with which we interact only in certain situations, for example, when we visit the clinic, the police station, or the mall, they are increasingly accompanying us every moment of the day, watching and analyzing every single thing that we do. As fish live in water, humans live in a digital bureaucracy, constantly inhaling and exhaling data. Each action we make leaves a trace of data, which is gathered and analyzed to identify patterns. Under the skin surveillance. For better or worse, the digital bureaucracy may not only monitor what we do in the world, but even observe what is happening inside our bodies. Take, for example, tracking eye movements. Since the early 2020s, CCTV cameras, as well as cameras in laptops and smartphones, have begun to routinely collect and analyze data on the movements of our eyes, including tiny changes to our pupils and irises lasting just a few milliseconds. Human agents are barely capable of even noticing such data, but computers can use it to calculate the direction of our gaze based on the shape of our pupils and irises and on the patterns of light they reflect. Similar methods can determine whether our eyes are fixating on a stable target, pursuing a moving target, or wandering around more haphazardly. From certain patterns of eye movements, computers can then distinguish, for example, moments of awareness from moments of distraction, and detail-oriented people from those who pay more attention to context. Computers could infer from our eyes many additional personality traits, like how open we are to new experiences, and estimate our level of expertise in various fields ranging from reading to surgery. Experts possessing well-honed strategies display systematic gaze patterns, whereas the eyes of novices wander aimlessly. Eye patterns also indicate our levels of interest in the objects and situations we encounter, and distinguish between positive, neutral, and negative interest. From this, it is possible to deduce our preferences in fields ranging from politics to sex. Much can also be known about our medical condition and our use of various substances. The consumption of alcohol and drugs, even at non-intoxicating doses, has measurable effects on eye and gaze properties, such as changes in pupil size and an impaired ability to fixate on moving objects. A digital bureaucracy may use all that information for benign purposes, such as by providing early detection for people suffering from drug abuse and mental illnesses. But it could obviously also form the foundations of the most intrusive totalitarian regimes in history. In theory, the dictators of the future could get their computer network to go much deeper than just watching our eyes. If the network wants to know our political views, personality traits, and sexual orientation, it could monitor processes inside our hearts and brains. The necessary biometric technology is already being developed by some governments and companies, like Elon Musk's Neuralink. Musk's company has conducted experiments on live rats, sheep, pigs, and monkeys, implanting electrical probes into their brains. Each probe contains up to 3,072 electrodes, capable of identifying electrical signals and potentially transmitting signals to the brain. In 2023, Neuralink received approval from US authorities to begin experiments on human beings, and in January 2024, it was reported that a first brain chip was implanted in a human. Musk speaks openly about his far-reaching plans for this technology, arguing that it can not only alleviate various medical conditions such as quadriplegia, four-limb paralysis, but also upgrade human abilities and thereby help humankind compete with AI. But it should be clear that at present, the Neuralink probes and all other similar biometric devices suffer from a host of technical problems that greatly limit their capabilities. It is difficult to accurately monitor bodily activities in the brain, heart, or anywhere else from outside the body, whereas implanting electrodes and other monitoring devices into the body is intrusive, dangerous, costly, and inefficient. Our immune system, for example, attacks implanted electrodes. Even more crucially, nobody yet has the biological knowledge necessary to deduce things like precise political opinions from under-the-skin data like brain activity. Scientists are far from understanding the mysteries of the human brain, or even of the mouse brain. Simply mapping every neuron, dendrite, and synapse in a mouse brain, let alone understanding the dynamics between them, is currently beyond humanity's computational abilities. Accordingly, while gathering data from inside people's brains is becoming more feasible, using such data to decipher our secrets is far from easy. One popular conspiracy theory of the early 2020s argues that sinister groups led by billionaires like Elon Musk are already implanting computer chips into our brains in order to monitor and control us. However, this theory focuses our anxieties on the wrong target. We should, of course, fear the rise of new totalitarian systems, but it is too soon to worry about computer chips implanted in our brains. People should instead worry about the smartphones on which they read these conspiracy theories. Suppose someone wants to know your political views. Your smartphone monitors which news channels you are watching and notes that you watch on average 40 minutes of Fox News and 40 seconds of CNN a day. Meanwhile, an implanted Neuralink computer chip monitors your heart rate and brain activity throughout the day and notes that your maximum heart rate was 120 beats per minute and that your amygdala is about 5% more active than the human average. Which data would be more useful to guess your political affiliation? The data coming from the smartphone or from the implanted chip? At present, the smartphone is still a far more valuable surveillance tool than biometric sensors. However, as biological knowledge increases, not least thanks to computers analyzing petabits of biometric data, under-the-skin surveillance might eventually come into its own, especially if it is linked to other monitoring tools. At that point, if biometric sensors register what happens to the heart rate and brain activity of millions of people as they watch a particular news item on their smartphones, that can teach the computer network far more than just our general political affiliation. The network could learn precisely what makes each human angry, fearful, or joyful, The network could then both predict and manipulate our feelings, selling us anything it wants, be it a product, a politician, or a war. The end of privacy. In a world where humans monitored humans, privacy was the default. But in a world where computers monitor humans, it may become possible for the first time in history to completely annihilate privacy. The most extreme and well-known cases of intrusive surveillance involve either exceptional times of emergency, like the COVID-19 pandemic, or places seen as exceptional to the normal order of things, such as the occupied Palestinian territories, the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region in China, the region of Kashmir in India, Russian-occupied Crimea, the US-Mexico border, and the Afghanistan-Pakistan borderlands. In these exceptional times and places, new surveillance technologies, combined with draconian laws and heavy police or military presence, have relentlessly monitored and controlled people's movements, actions, and even feelings. What is crucial to realize, though, is that AI-based surveillance systems are being deployed on an enormous scale, and not only in such states of exception. They are now part and parcel of normal life everywhere. The post-privacy era is taking hold in authoritarian countries ranging from Belarus to Zimbabwe, as well as in democratic metropolises like London and New York. Whether for good or ill, governments intent on combating crime, suppressing dissent, or countering internal threats, real or imaginary, blankets whole territories with a ubiquitous online and offline surveillance network, equipped with spyware, CCTV cameras, facial recognition, and voice recognition software, and vast searchable databases. If a government wishes, its surveillance network can reach everywhere, from markets to places of worship, from schools to private residences. And while not every government is willing or able to install cameras inside people's homes, algorithms regularly watch us even in our living rooms, bedrooms, and bathrooms via our own computers and smartphones. Governmental surveillance networks also routinely collect biometric data from entire populations with or without their knowledge. For example, when applying for a passport, more than 140 countries oblige their citizens to provide fingerprints, facial scans, or iris scans. When we use our passports to enter a foreign country, that country often demands that we provide it, too, with our fingerprints, facial scans, or iris scans. As citizens or tourists walk along the streets of Delhi, Beijing, Seoul, or London, their movements are likely to be recorded. For these cities, and many others around the world, are covered by more than 100 surveillance cameras on average per square kilometre. Altogether in 2023, more than 1 billion CCTV cameras were operative globally, which is about one camera per 8 people. Any physical activity a person engages in leaves a data trace. Every purchase made is recorded in some database. Online activities like messaging friends, sharing photos, paying bills, reading news, booking appointments, or ordering taxis can all be recorded as well. The resulting ocean of data can then be analysed by AI tools to identify unlawful activities, suspicious patterns, missing persons, disease carriers, or political dissidents. As with every powerful technology, these tools can be used for either good or bad purposes. Following the storming of the US Capitol on January 6, 2021, the FBI and other US law enforcement agencies used state-of-the-art surveillance tools to track down and arrest the rioters. As reported in a Washington Post investigation, these agencies relied not only on footage from the CCTV cameras in the Capitol, but also on social media posts, license plate readers throughout the country, cell tower location records, and pre-existing databases. One Ohio man wrote on Facebook that he had been in Washington that day to witness history. A subpoena was issued to Facebook, which provided the FBI with the man's Facebook posts, as well as his credit card information and phone number. This helped the FBI to match the man's driver's license photo to CCTV footage from the Capitol. Another warrant issued to Google yielded the exact geolocation of the man's smartphone on January 6, enabling agents to map his every movement from his entry point into the Senate chamber all the way to the office of Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Relying on license plate footage, the FBI pinpointed the movements of a New York man from the moment he crossed the Henry Hudson Bridge at 6:06:08 on the morning of January 6 on his way to the Capitol, until he crossed the George Washington Bridge at 23:59:22 that night on his way back home. An image taken by a camera on Interstate 95 showed an oversized Make America Great Again hat on the man's dashboard. The hat was matched to a Facebook selfie in which the man appeared wearing it. He further incriminated himself with several videos he posted to Snapchat from within the Capitol. Another rioter sought to protect himself from detection by wearing a face mask on January 6, avoiding live streaming, and using a cell phone registered in his mother's name, but it availed him little. The FBI's algorithms managed to match video footage from January 6, 2021 to a photo from the man's 2017 passport application. They also matched a distinctive Knights of Columbus jacket he wore on January 6 to the jacket he wore on a different occasion, which was captured in a YouTube clip. The phone registered in his mother's name was geolocated to inside the Capitol, and a license plate reader recorded his car near the Capitol on the morning of January 6. Facial recognition algorithms and AI searchable databases are now standard tools of police forces all over the world. They are deployed not only in cases of national emergencies or for reasons of state security, but for everyday policing tasks. In 2009, a criminal gang abducted the 3-year-old Gui Hao while he was playing outside his parents' shop in Sichuan Province, China. The boy was then sold to a family in Guangdong Province, about 1,500 kilometers away. In 2014, the leader of the child trafficking gang was arrested, but it proved impossible to locate Gui Hao and other victims. "The appearance of the children would have changed so much," explained a police investigator, "that even their parents would not have been able to recognize them." In 2019, however, a facial recognition algorithm managed to identify the now 13-year-old Gui Hao, and the teenager was reunited with his family. To correctly identify Gui Hao, the AI relied on an old photograph of his taken when he was a toddler. The AI simulated what Gui Hao must look like as a 13-year-old, taking into account the drastic impact of maturation as well as potential changes in hair color and hairstyle, and compared the resulting simulation to real-life footage. In 2023, even more remarkable rescues were reported. Yueshuan Lei was abducted in 2001 when he was 3 years old, and Hao Chen went missing in 1998, also at age 3. The parents of both children never gave up hope of finding them. For more than 20 years, they crisscrossed China in search of them, placed advertisements, and offered monetary rewards for any relevant information. In 2023, facial recognition algorithms helped locate both missing boys, now adult men in their 20s. Such technology currently helps to find lost children not only in China, but also in other countries like India, where tens of thousands of children go missing every year. Meanwhile, in Denmark, the soccer club Brøndby IF began in July 2019 to use facial recognition technology in its home stadium to identify and ban football hooligans. As up to 30,000 fans stream into the stadium to watch a match, they are asked to remove masks, hats, and glasses so a computer can scan their faces and compare them to a list of banned troublemakers. Crucially, the procedure has been vetted and approved in accordance with the EU's strict